From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're going to spend both hours of today's program on the death of Daniel Prude in Rochester police custody. It happened after police were called in the early morning hours of March 23rd, and by now you probably know the story. It was a freezing and snowy night. Prude complied with their instructions, and they handcuffed him. When Prude began ranting, and police say he was spitting, they covered his head with a so-called spit sock. They restrained him, several officers restraining him with force, and eventually Prude began crying, saying he was going to die. He suffocated, and he did later die. All summer long, Mayor Warren has said that Rochester does not have the problems that other cities have with policing. She knew about this case, and she said yesterday that an executive order from the governor prevented her from telling the public. We've now spoken to many attorneys in many different practices. Every one of them tells us that the mayor is wrong, that nothing precluded her from informing the public about this. So where do we go next here? What does reform really look like? What changes are needed? What does this case say about our community and our society? Let's welcome our guests now. Reverend Lewis Stewart is president of United Christian Leadership Ministry. Reverend, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Ponder is the Diversity and Inclusion Officer for the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Daniel, welcome back to the program. Are you there, Daniel? You might have been on mute. We're going to see if we've got Daniel. I think I've got Adrian Hale, Strategic Initiatives Manager at the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce and a community leader who was out on the streets yesterday helping lead some of the demonstrations. Adrian, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for asking me, Evan.
What I want to do first is I want to make sure that we hear the comments in full from the mayor and from the police union head about our own city. First, let's go back to June 10th. This is 2 weeks after the killing of George Floyd. There were calls in many American cities, including Rochester, for police reform, defunding police in part or in full, changing police responsibility. That day, the mayor said that she did not think that police defunding made a lot of sense because she said that many in the community didn't want that, that our community was strong, and that things were not like Minneapolis here. Things were not like other cities. This is the sound recorded by WXXI's James Brown with Mayor Lovely Warren on June 10th on policing.
I know that there's work that needs to continue to happen. So I think that we have to understand that we have challenges and we are able and always willing to improve. A lot of the things that other cities are facing right now, we have already done in Rochester. Nothing happens in a vacuum, but I can tell you that by light years, Rochester is ahead of the curve, and we will continue to do what is necessary to make sure that our community feels safe and our officers feel safe, and that we can work in partnership to uplift our entire community together.
That was June 10th, 2 weeks after the killing of George Floyd and more than 2 months after the killing of Daniel Prude. The mayor was one of the only ones in city government who knew about the killing of Daniel Prude at the time. She had not disclosed it publicly, and she was telling the public that we were light years ahead of other cities. Here, just a few days ago, earlier this week, is Mike Mazzeo, head of the Rochester Police Union, regarding police problems.
We don't have the problems that other parts of this country have. It should start being recognized by the mayor and city council members. Start talking about what we do here in this city that's right, that should be a model for other areas, mainly because of the ability to collect a bargain.
And so yesterday, the mayor was asked, if you knew about this, why didn't you tell the public during the summer of George Floyd, with everything happening, how could you keep this quiet? The mayor said she wanted to tell. She wanted to tell the public. But there is an executive order from the governor from 2015 regarding the handling of these kinds of cases. That executive order says that the state attorney general's office will step in and handle the investigations to have an impartial outside investigator. And the mayor says within that order was the reason that she couldn't tell the public and had to keep it quiet. Let's listen to the mayor.
Our law department has indicated to me that I have to make sure that I adhere to executive order, to the attorney general's instructions of them concluding their investigation. And so I just want people to be very clear, this is not something that's in our wheelhouse.
in our control at this moment in time. And had it been, then for me, this would be something that we would have talked about months ago. Unfortunately, I can't because of what my law department is telling me that I have to adhere to, and that's the executive order, that's the Attorney General's office, investigation.
So let me say a few things before I turn it over to our guests for their response, and then we're going to talk about where we go from here. First of all, listeners of Connections probably know that the mayor hasn't been back on this program since July of 2017. Her last appearance was during her last campaign for reelection. I questioned her about allegations of improprieties with campaign finance. She was very angry with me that day. She let me know it on the air. She let me know it afterward. And she has said that she would not come back on the program since. She has stayed true to that. And she does not let anyone from City Hall come on this program. That is the mayor's choice. And I have said all along that if she felt she was treated unfairly, that that she shouldn't be back on. That if she doesn't think that I'm a trustworthy interviewer, then she shouldn't be back on. I disagree with that characterization, but I respect the mayor, and I respect her decision. And I think it's unfortunate, but I have to own that, and that's where we are. So, listeners, if you think that I am not an impartial sort of observer of the mayor in this, then you should take what I'm about to say with a discount, because that's human nature. But I'm trying to be impartial. I'm a resident of the city of Rochester. I care about this. I've spoken to many attorneys from different offices. I've texted and emailed with different attorneys, all kinds of different backgrounds. They've taken a look at the executive order that the mayor's talking about. There is nobody who agrees with the mayor's contention that she couldn't talk about this. There are only two attorneys in the city that I'm aware of who agree with the mayor's contention, and that is the mayor herself, she's an attorney, and the city attorney. That's it. There's nothing that indicates she can't talk. There's nothing from the governor's office that indicates she couldn't have told the public. There's nothing from the AG's office that indicates she had to keep this quiet. But let's also assume that even if there was, can you imagine if a couple of months ago the mayor had come out and said, hey, listen, I'm not supposed to talk about this, but you need to know about this, and you're going to know about this, and we're going to lead, and here's what we're going to do. I don't think she would have been thrown out of a job or thrown in jail. And there's nothing that indicates she would have. But clearly, she is standing by the claim that she was precluded from talking. And that's why she didn't. And that's why she said all summer that we don't have the problems we have. So let's start there. Reverend Lewis Stewart, does our community have the problems that other communities have with policing?
Yes, we do, Evan. And we have had this problem for decades. And I remember being involved with protest in regards to Alicia McCullough. That was the great Jim McCullough's daughter back in the 70s, I believe, when she was killed by a police officer. Then there was Denise Hawkins, who was also killed by a police officer. Calvin Green, who was shot while he was hiding upstairs unarmed, and he was killed. And there was also Ken Jackson. And then lately there was a gentleman on Tremont Street who was also tasered and died because of the tasering. And the coroner said that his death was a homicide. And it's the same thing with Mr. Daniel Prude. So we have these problems just as other cities have. To say that we don't have them means that you're living on the moon somewhere. I'm looking at this where it says Mike Mazzeo said the same thing. We don't have the problems that other cities have. We should be a model for others. What? A model in the police killing our citizens and especially black people? So we can't boast on that. That was never a boast. It is superficial. It is insubstantial. We have the problems, Evan.
Okay. Daniel Ponder, What were you thinking when you heard the mayor say yesterday that she couldn't have said anything publicly, and then when you think about what she said on June 10th in this community?
I mean, I just thought it was, you know, to be frank, a lie. It was false. And let's look at the timeline. This happened in March. The executive order didn't come out until July. So we have March, April, May, June, where she decided to stay silent before there was even an executive order. And looking at the executive order, there's nothing in there that said she had to be silent. So it's clear to me that this was an attempt to cover this up. But I also think about the meetings that we've had with her as members of this Black Lives Matter movement, and how our issues and grievances have been seen as, you know, this doesn't happen here. This isn't something we're dealing with here. And to say that to our face when she knew that Daniel Prude was dead is just astonishing to me.
Adrian Hale, what do you think?
I mean, first off, building on the first two points already made, I mean, it's just disheartening because it's a continuation of breaking the trust between the community and their government and the community and their elected leadership. And what really, I think, you know, disheartens me more than anything is the fact that, you know, we've often heard from this administration and from leadership right now about how Black people matter, about how Black lives matter. You know, constantly we hear allegations of racism, but for this to come out, you know, and this is coming out after the city has used resources to, you know, release a report of 700 pages worth of looters who stole items that can be replaced. His life cannot be replaced. And they covered that up. And there's a difference in the way that I heard, you know, the leadership speaking about how we're going to come after you, we're going to find you, and then to not see that same level of conviction when it comes to the way that Black people in this community are treated by their own police officers and now their leadership, I think is the most disheartening fact of all.
Mm. So let's talk about what happens next then, because during a time of tension, of pain, of tumult and calls for reform, you know, it's a question of where the leadership lies and what direction the city is going to take here. Adrian, if you feel like there's been a, you used the term a cover up, if there hasn't been an honest rendering of what happened from police and from City Hall, where does the leadership come from?
And so, you know, and that's my thing, right? Obviously, we heard the chief say yesterday that this wasn't a cover-up, but then I would only have to ask, well, then where's the accountability? Many members of city council said yesterday that they didn't know about it, so then why aren't they calling for accountability over leadership and amongst their ranks, you know? And so I think at some point, and I said this yesterday at the rally on Jefferson Avenue, there comes a time where, whether it's generational, whether it's, you know, persuasion or ideological or just based on principle and values, one's basic human decency and humanity, where if you want the spirit of the community to change, we have to become that spirit. And if we want the conscience of this community to change, then we have to become that conscious. And I think right now what you're going to see is many people lift up their voices. You're going to see people take to the streets. And I think in all of their capacity, you know, in my day job, I'm working on racial equity when it comes to economic development and workforce development and our education system and our regional talent strategy. And that's where my focus is. You know, you have Reverend Stewart, who does that as a community leader and as a man of God. You have Daniel Ponder, who does that as a musician and as an attorney with the Public Defender's Office, right? There are so many of us in this capable coalition where we are really, I think, right now assembling all the necessary actors to really change the culture and climate in this city and ultimately the decision makers in this city.
Daniel Ponder, where do you see the leadership coming from, and how do you sort of chart a course forward given the mistrust that you now feel with those in positions of leadership?
I see the leadership coming from Ashley Gantt, from Stanley Martin, from Anthony Hall, from Adrian Hale. What I saw yesterday at that march was beautiful. I see it coming from Reverend Stewart. What I saw at his press conference today was beautiful. I know that the people are in control, that the city belongs to the people, that the elected officials work for us. We know that many of the city council members and the mayor are up for re-election in 2021. Last night, they were also registering people to vote. The power completely belongs to the people. When the politicians don't show accountability and don't show leadership, then we take that from them. And that's exactly what Adrian is saying. We should not feel downtrodden. We should not feel disempowered.
Sure.
We should feel like, okay, it's time for us to step up. And I think that's what's happening in this community.
Reverend Stewart, how do you see it?
Well, I see, first of all, we've got to take our destiny into our own hands. That's number one. Number two, I see the leadership from this younger generation coming from people like Adrian Hale and Danielle Ponder and others like Ashley Gant and Iman and Stanley Martin and really a group of other people whom this legacy relative to civil rights and human rights is going to be passed on to. At one time, there was a dearth, I think, of young leadership, youthful leadership here in Rochester, and that was back during the 90s. And I was really taking out of sorts on that because of the fact, well, who's going to carry on this legacy after Reverend Graves passes away and others and myself? And I am satisfied now that the torch has been passed to a newer and younger generation, those who are on the show with me, those who are coming up. And I am confident that they have this community in mind. I see that they have character, they have integrity, and they have a passion for really building this community and looking for change. So I think theirs is going to be a transactional leadership. I love what I see, them working together to build. And so I'm confident in that.
Let me just briefly address a listener who emailed me to say, Evan, why are you calling this a killing and not a death? You do not know that it's a killing, and you are inciting anger in listeners by saying that. So, Laura, I think what I referred to was a death in police custody in the Daniel Prude case and the killing of George Floyd. George Floyd would be alive today if not for a knee on his head. That is a killing. I think that is factual.
Evan,
yeah, that's yeah. Go ahead, Adrian. Yeah.
Evan, if I may, I just want to make it very clear that the Monroe County Medical Examiner has rendered this a homicide.
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
Just so we're clear. So I just want people to know that this has been rendered a homicide.
Yeah. So, right. And I am not trying to incite, Laura, but I am trying to be direct with what we know. And so let's talk about what ought to change here. So, Reverend Stewart, just from this case alone, when you see that, at least my understanding is that by April, Rochester police looked at this case and said, yep, the officers acted according to their training. What needs to happen next, Reverend Stewart?
That made me so angry when Chief Singletary made that statement. And according to us who are on the show and thousands of others in the community, those cops did not act accordingly. When you looked at that video and saw them wrapping that hood on his face and tightening it up at the base of his neck, right there they were strangling this man. They were strangling him. And then they put their knee in the middle of his back and pulled up on him. They knew what they were doing. And then there was a police sergeant, a supervisor, who stood nearby and did not do a thing. This was lynching by police. This is what this was. And I'm appalled by what Chief Singletary said. So our next step, as I called for in the press conference, is number one, we need to look at the fact that four of these officers, including the sergeant and whoever else was involved, that these people need to be brought up on charges of murder. Whatever the law says that is, and Daniel Ponder would know this better than I would, all right, they need to be prosecuted on charges of murder, on charges of deliberate homicide, because that's what that was, deliberate homicide. And then I think the second thing we need to do as far as pursuing that course of action, the other course of action, is to look at a systemic transformation of the Rochester Police Department. And that's what we need to look at. I think that there are white supremacist elements in that police department that need to be rooted out.
Mm-hmm.
There are some other issues there that need to be dealt with in terms of mental health practitioners. And I've been studying the police for a long time now. And there are certainly systemic changes that we need to look at. So the whole question is, I was just meeting with some of the Black Lives Matter leaders today, Ashley Gant and Imam Abid and others. And so we're having a community meeting tonight at 6 o'clock at First Church of God, 334 Clarissa Street, to address some of these issues. And hopefully we will have a good attendance.
Danielle Ponder, let's create a list of what is achievable and what needs to happen.
So I first want to say that this was a murder. It was a murder that we all witnessed with our own lives. We're talking about a depraved indifference to human life, right? So that's what we're looking at when we're looking at second-degree murder, is that they acted recklessly. When someone has a bag over their head and they're telling you that they can't breathe and you do nothing about it, that shows a depraved indifference to that person's life. Evan, what do we need to do about it? I'm going to be honest with you. I'm done with reform. I am absolutely done with reform.
Mm-hmm.
We have been trying to reform the police since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. City Paper just did a really great recap of all the reforms that have happened and all the people that have died as we've implemented these reforms. Body cams was going to be the final thing. Clergy's on parole, community policing, all of these things. Black people have been promised would change it. And their sons and daughters are still dying. And we're acting as if we can't find a better way.
Mm-hmm.
We have to disband this police department. It has to be over for the Rochester Police Department. And for those who are worried, what it means to get rid of the police is not that we do this tomorrow, that we begin a process of reallocating resources to people who are better equipped to deal with these issues, and that over the next few years, we reimagine and create a new system. But do not use that reform word with me. Do not use that reform word with me. My mother was here in 1964 protesting, and they brought a commission together to look at how we can do better. How many chances do they get, Evan? How many people are you comfortable with dying? How many people are you? One more? Two more? 100 more? You got to be kidding me.
Well, to Danielle's point about reforms, there's a piece that just dropped today, and I urge our listeners to read it and share it in RochesterCityNewspaper.com. 50 years of Rochester police reform yielded few returns. It's a piece, a historical investigation by Gino Finelli, and it unfortunately reflects exactly what Danielle Ponder is talking about, the kinds of a big promise or big effort for 50 years in this community leading to the present moment of very little change. I mean, some of the headlines you see today, you could have seen in 1984, you could have seen in 1990, you could have seen in 1972. Right. They are roughly the same. And Gino's piece is vital to understanding that, because when we talk about reform, to Danielle's point, a lot of it's been tried. But before I turn to Adrian Hale for his thoughts on this, Danielle, there is a hesitation or a nervousness, even among progressive Americans who generally might agree with the sentiment of what you're saying, when they hear we're done with police. Now, you say it's not going to happen overnight, but give me a sense of what it looks like eventually when it gets to where you want it to be, Danielle. What does it look like?
So just a few things, because I saw that article you posted. One, I don't think it's that people are afraid to get rid of police. People want to know that we are going to address public safety. It's not that Black folks want police in our community, as that article suggested. I think Black people want a solution to crime in our community. So the majority of crimes that we're looking at misdemeanor. So let's start right there, right? We're talking about petty larcenies. We're talking about people who have substance abuse issues. Why do people commit petty larcenies? Either because they're living in poverty or because they have substance abuse issues. So it looks like poor people being able to get some of those rehabilitation centers that rich, wealthy people in California get. It looks like people who are living in poverty, especially black folks, getting reparations. That's what it looks like. It looks like them getting home loans. It looks like CNAs getting living wages. It looks like ending the school to prison pipeline by not over suspending black youth. It looks like alternative services for what are largely misdemeanor, petty crimes. And I don't think that there shouldn't be an emergency response team, but we know that 7% of crimes in Rochester are violent crimes. So we need an emergency response team for what, 7%? But mostly, Evan, I think people aren't even, they don't even know what the police do. People say, how could we have someone without a gun show up at a shooting? Do you know what officers do when they come to a shooting? They write a report. They write a report. This is not law and order. This is not Fast and Furious. Officers in Rochester, for the most part, are not doing high-speed chases and shooting at shooters. They arrive when things have already resolved. Do we need armed men from Parma to do that? Or can we create something in our own community where men and women in our own community can protect our community? And
now,
there may
really
be
quick, I was just going to say, before you shift, Danielle, I want you, can you just give a little bit of insight about the amount of crime that actually gets solved, in particular homicides and shootings?
And let me jump in, Adrian. Before Danielle answers, Adrian's phone's flickering. We're just going to kind of reset with Adrian, make sure we've got the phone in good shape there. And Danielle, go ahead.
You want me to go or eight? Okay. I don't know who's going. So let me just give everyone a list so they can understand this. For mental health issues, we have trained mental health workers. For drug addiction, we have drug rehabilitation centers that are effective. For poverty, we have reparations. There's tons of research that shows the only way we can reduce the racial wealth gap is by giving direct, explicit investments into the black community. Those are the majority of the crimes that we are talking about. And for violent crimes, we have an emergency response team that is from our community, that looks like our community. But this practice of policing, which is bringing in white men from the suburbs, many of them who may have never even interacted with a person of color, and giving them a gun needs to be obsolete. That type of policing has to completely be done.
Okay. Adrian Hale.
Yeah, can you hear me better now?
I can. Go ahead.
All right, perfect. So just building off of both Danielle and Reverend Stewart's points, I think that what the community needs to be aware of, and I'm talking about the broader community now, because, again, I think it's going to take various stakeholders in order for us to move not just Rochester, but our society in general forward, is we have to recognize that the people who are victimized by the current system that exists, they are not comfortable with having police officers who kill citizens and neighbors on the street with guns. And I think, too, just to Danielle's point about being done with reform and thinking about systemic transformation, one of the things that I do day to day is workforce development and economic development. And what folks are really starting to ask is, think about what public safety looks like in a different context. So if you avoid the creation of all these social maladies, like illiteracy, like innumeracy, like unemployment, like the absenteeism, like low home ownership rates, and all the other health issues that come as a result of poverty, like type 2 diabetes, mental illness, heart diseases, you name it, pneumatic diseases, you name it, that the world looks very different. And so what I want us to see is that we cannot respond to every issue with a hammer. And that's pretty much what we're doing now, because of the police department is designed in a way that it executes violence. And so what he is proposing is, how do we reallocate dollars to prevent the occurrence of crime altogether? Because we don't need a reactionary force that comes, takes reports, and then never solves the issue, or go further to establishing peace within our communities. So that's the first part. And then the second part is, how do we also preempt and prevent altogether to the point where the appropriate response comes to whatever the need is? So she went back to saying that there was only 7% of a crime in Rochester is actually violent crime, meaning the great majority and plurality of crimes is nonviolent crimes. So what do we, what, how do we run a response to homelessness, to unemployment or to poverty and crimes associated with that, to substance abuse, to mental illness? And that does take thinking outside the box. But ultimately, even to your point about reparations, Danielle, it is a challenge for us to rethink the way we have organized our community and society. And imagine what would the world look like if we did not consent to this kind, these kinds of conditions afflicting Black and Hispanic people. And then my last point is simply this. If we allow ourselves to fall into the cycle that we've seen, which is, you know, where you talked about already, there's going to be a changing of the narrative, and it's going to be followed up by disinterest by people who feel as though if it's not my problem, it's not a problem, then this is going to be the repeating cycle that we constantly see. And I'm with both of my co-hosts today that I don't want to lose another life. Like, we have to agree as a community that we want to design a system and organize our community in a way that does not lose a single another Black life just for being Black.
Before we take listener phone calls, Stephanie in Rochester, John and Webster, we'll get you in just a second. Robert writes to the program and says, Evan, do the panelists think that the police chief should resign because he conducted an internal investigation that ruled there was no foul play in this case? And are we comfortable with paying him and the mayor to lie? When citizens lie about criminal cases, we go to jail. Reverend Stewart, do you want to see any resignations after this case?
I don't want to see any resignations, not with the chief of police and the current chief of police and the mayor. And the reason being is because we never call for resignations from Simonelli. When Simonelli was involved in some things relative to the Ricky Bryant case, the Brenda Hardaway case, situations in which Black folk were severely beaten. We never called for the resignation of Tom Richards or others in that sense. What we do need to do is we need to have a sit-down talk with Chief Singletary and the mayor and let them know exactly what we think and our expectations. And we need to keep on doing this. And we need to tell them that, really, we pay their salaries, and it's not the other way around. And so we are expecting them to do the will of the people. I wanted to say something else, too, because my two friends did have some good things to say. Let me say that there certainly needs to be a change in our community and what I call changing the color of policing. We need more people of color policing the community. And we all know this for a fact. Historically, you can have white killers running around and the police go after these white killers. And this is recently. And the fact is they capture these killers. They treat them nice. They do great things for them. They give them strokes. But when it comes to Black people, they shoot Black people dead. Case in point, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, the 17-year-old walking down the street with the automatic rifle, assault weapon, you know, he had killed two people, and yet they treat him to ice water and everything like that. Or the other one that was responsible for killing those 9 or 10 worshipers in Mother Emanuel Church in South Carolina, they took him out for a hamburger, but yet they kill us. So there is quite a big difference in the way we are treated by the police. And certainly that has a lot to do with the connection between American systemic racism as it is and police systemic racism. So there's a correlation between the two. So that certainly we need to look at systemic transformation in the police department. Now, what that is going to look like, what that can envision, we don't know. But we do know the fact that when you send the police out to solve something, they're not going to solve anything. They're going to escalate a problem.
And we've seen that pattern time and time again, usually ending in the loss of life of people of color. So there certainly needs to be a change. One of the things that I would even suggest is that there needs to be a people's commission. Now, the mayor put this commission together on raise to look at police issues and things of that sort. But we need a people's commission. We need a commission that comes with ideas directly from the people in terms of how to restructure and transform not only our society, but also the different institutions within our society.
Daniel Ponder, do you agree with Reverend Stewart that now is not the time to seek resignations from the police chief or the mayor?
You know, I'm just not sure about that yet. I've been thinking about it, and I'm not sure.
Okay. Adrian Hale?
I'll just repeat my comments from earlier. I'm more curious on why city council says they were left out of the loop, and that's the actual oversight body of city government, and they haven't called for any resignations or any accountability. And I'm curious of why they have not.
City Council put out a statement last night, and after speaking to a number of members of City Council, not every member of City Council, I can't say all of them, but a number of them, there were members of City Council who were very angry to have been left out of the loop on this case. They said they essentially found out when the public did. The statement from City Council on the death of Daniel Prude concludes with, "We must rectify inadequacies in our policies, practices, and procedures and improve our communication, both internally and externally." That is technical speak for we cannot believe we weren't told about this. And Adrian, to you, is that a strong statement or what do you make of the City Council statement there?
I think it's a political statement. And I think going back to what you asked earlier about leadership. See, here's the problem with local government leadership. Everybody has a vision and an idea of where they want to be. They want to go on and become governors and attorney generals and senators and congresspersons and all these other, you know, high offices to the point where they do not do the kind of governing that the people need at the local level because they need certain special interests in order to achieve and attain their goals and objectives for themselves. And I think the number one thing that we need to think about in our reconceptualizing of what is the kind of leadership we need right now in this moment, because here's the reality. The world is never going to go back to the way it was before the pandemic, right, before these racial uprisings. And there has been an implicit policy from our local leaders of wait it out, let it blow over. People have a 48-hour news cycle mindset, but that's not going to happen. You see it all over the country and the world. Things are never going to go back. So to Danielle's point, transformation is inevitable. And we have to think about, do we want to continue to elect leaders who just look like us and share our color or who actually share our causes? Do we want to elect leaders who put their self-interest ahead of the public interest? Because we've seen where that is going to get us. So again, going back to my point about the capable coalition of actors, we need everyone from the C-suite to the custodian, from Genesee Street to Gates, from Parcells Avenue to Pittsburgh, to really galvanize a sense of conviction, a sense of care, and a sense of commitment to turn our city and our community around. Because all of these challenges, like we're talking about public safety today, but what I focus on 99% of the time is how our education system works, how our workforce system operates, how our world of work and our workplaces operate, how our economic systems function. And Black people are on the losing end of all of those systems. And then so subsequently, we deal with the problems of crime and criminality, which are really are consequences, but not causes unto themselves. So we can't keep trying to coerce a behavior change without also trying to deal with the conditions that produce the behavior. Make no mistake. Our actions do not cause our situation. Our actions are a response and a consequence of our situation. And so I said this yesterday at the rally. I'll say it again. What Black Rochester needs, and there is no single Black Rochester. There are Black Rochesters, right? We are a very diverse community ideologically, religious-wise, socioeconomically speaking. You know, the Black community has always been diverse, but what Black communities need is to be treated with the same level of complexity and sophistication as any other community. And we don't need a lecture. We don't need opinions. We don't need saviors. What we need is people who are willing to resolve with us that we deserve the same opportunity, the same safety, and the same freedom to live self-creating, self-directing lives. And that's all we're asking for.
Well, let's get some phone calls. And as we do that, listeners, just as a lot of people suspected, this story is now national news, and it is national news across spectrums of media. DeRay McKesson is talking about this story today. There are many more reporters talking about this story. The Drudge Report, a longtime conservative news accumulation website. Above the fold, there's a picture, a still from the video of what happened that night to Daniel Prude. And the headline in the Drudge Report, above the fold, "Laughing cops hood and choke black man, Rochester erupts at shock video." That's at the Drudge Report. National story. Stephanie in Rochester, first on the phone. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Yes, good afternoon, Evan. This is a comment. These cops did not act accordingly. Let's just be completely clear. And if that is the according policy for how to treat mental health arrests, then they need to not be cops. And the cops in general should not be taking care of mental health issues. I know for a fact, though, personally, that this is not how cops always respond to mental health arrests. And here's why. My younger brother has severe mental health issues. He is on the autistic spectrum. And for a period of, I'd say, 7 years, we had to call the police to get help because he was having severe mental health distress. And we needed help. And the police came in for, honestly, countless mental health arrests. And my brother is almost 6'6". At the time, he was over 300 pounds. He was a big, big guy. And he was silent, and he resisted, and he baited and taunted and spit at cops. And never
is your brother a big
abused.
Black man?
No, that's where, I think that's
sure
where she's
going. He sure is not. Mm-hmm. He's white. Mm-hmm. And never once did they abuse or mock him. They did not infringe upon his human rights.
Yep.
He is white. And they took extra care because my family was nearby as witnesses, and that we demanded that they respect his rights, even though he was having a mental health crisis and was acting like just the most out of control, crazy, violent person that you can imagine. He is still alive. He has since gotten a ton of help through the state and is now thankfully living in a home which he loves with people who take care of him on a 24-hour basis with four other individuals, and he is living the best life that he is able to live. Now, that was a long time coming, and he would not have had that opportunity, I don't think. I don't believe for a second if he had been black, he would have been killed during one of those mental health arrests, if they had treated him like that.
Yeah, Stephanie, thank you for the call. Go, I think Adrian wants to jump in. Go ahead, Adrian.
If I may, Evan, I just want to say, and I'm glad that she gave that testimony, because what some of our allies need to understand is this spectrum of, you know, disrespectful behavior and thinking. You know, if you have ignorance on one end and hate on the other, we need to acknowledge the part, like the motivation of hate. We have to stop calling everything ignorance, because we exonerate bad behavior every time we assume that it's ignorance, when in reality we have to acknowledge that there are elements in our community and in this country who deeply believe in a racial hierarchy where your place in that hierarchy is based on who you are. And one thing I just want to say too, and I'm so glad to be on with Danielle and with Reverend Stewart, is that I also need our allies to become comfortable with black voices speaking black experiences that don't have to be modified in order to be palatable to white ears. Like, if we're really going to deal with these issues, we have to begin honest, open, transparent conversations, because what we need to resolve
is that we have a lot of work to do. And just ignoring it and calling it ignorance is not going to get us there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the ignorance is just a nomenclature for an excuse. And
right.
It's not an excuse, because a lot of this ideological white supremacy of practices and behaviors comes from a certain type of thinking. And it's not ignorant. It's planned and it's deliberate. And that's why it erupts always in violence against black people.
So
that's right.
Let me ask Daniel Ponder to comment on a couple of things here. First of all, to Stephanie's point, contrasting her brother's experience with what we saw with Daniel Prude, you know, we have another listener who was just asking what looked like the total lack of compassion, an unwillingness to put a blanket on Daniel Prude in 30-degree weather when he's nude in the street. Is that a bug or a feature of policing? And then if you could, Danielle, just to kind of add to that, a couple of listeners have said, well, hey, earlier that night or the previous day, didn't he end up going to the hospital for mental health issues? Wasn't he released? My experience has been the mental health system is pretty overloaded right now, and it's not always a good outcome even when people go the mental health route. There's a lot of frustration there. I think, Danielle, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think part of the call that you and a number of people have made in this community is not to say, hey, just make it a mental health call, it'll be fine, but to say we're going to reallocate resources so there's a lot more strength and support on the mental health side so you don't have Daniel Prude end up in the hospital or at strong psych and is let out in a couple of hours until, you know, you're out of here. Good luck to you when he's talking about suicide, when he's, talking about self-harm. Is that right?
Right. So mental health folks and people who have organizations that deal with mental health should not be having to beg for, on GoFundMe to raise money, should not be having to applying for all of these grants when we're giving police $100 million. We can better fund these services. Bell Hooks said something in her book, Black People and Self-Esteem. We should have a mental health office ran by people of color. Almost on every corner in the hood. We are a people that have experienced trauma, collective trauma by this country. And no one has ever offered any type of healing for that trauma. So imagine what we could do if we took even half of the $100 million that RPD gets in order to ensure that our people have a space that where they can deal with mental health issues. So no, I don't think anyone's saying, well, let's just throw a therapist out there. But we're saying holistically, let's improve our mental health system by putting dollars in it so that they can be culturally competent, so that they can be effective, and so that they can be the ones that deal with this issue.
All right, before we go ahead.
Let me just add to what Danielle said. At one time, psychiatrists used to believe that black folk did not get depressed. That was a belief. Secondly, is that the black churches has always been the first line of defense relative to mental health issues. Prayer, singing, and things of that sort in the church, and listening to a sermon that can uplift you from the day-to-day pain and suffering and drudgery that you're feeling under racism or even your own life, that helped. Now, the fact is, what needs to happen is the reallocation of some of those police funds needs to go into funding mental health practitioners who need to be based basically in our religious institutions, who can go out and reach out and help people and work with people in the neighborhood. And that's right. Another way of re-envisioning what some of that can look like, because we do suffer from collective trauma as well as individual trauma based upon the centuries of racism that has been inflicted upon us.
All right. So as we get ready to close, Adrian, just some final thoughts from you, kind of building on the point you made earlier that diverse coalitions don't always agree on every detail, but you do need leadership to move it forward. And a number of our listeners have pointed me to polling from a month ago. All summer long, it feels like we've seen polling evolve on, you know, what do Americans think about defund the police? What do black Americans think? The latest Gallup polling shows that 61% of black Americans do not want less police, 20% want more, 19% want less, but just about all black Americans want better
policing. So I know there's a lot of different views. How do you pull it forward knowing there's a diversity of opinions on what should happen next year, Adrian?
So I think when we stop focusing on people's position and we focus more on their interests, then we'll make it a lot further. Hmm. You know, unity doesn't necessarily mean uniformity. And I think that's where we've messed things up. You know, back in the days that Reverend Stewart talked about when he started this from Saturday at the commemoration of the March on Washington, you know, what we call the civil rights movement in pop culture is really the Black freedom movement. Okay, you always mm-hmm. had a diverse set of ideologies of Black folks. You had Dr. King and the Supreme Court and SNCC who were asking for civil rights, but then you had Angela Davis and Huey P. Newton and Sophie Carmichael yes. calling on a complete overhaul in socialism and yes. communism. And then you also had the Nation of Islam calling for a complete mm-hmm. Black state, right? But they were all committed to the elevation of Black people out of conditions that were unfavorable to their success or their self-actualizing. And what I want us just to understand is we don't have to always agree on tactics or objectives, mm-hmm. but we do have to agree on where it is that we want to go as a community and a society.
There you go.
Adrian Hale is a strategic initiatives manager at the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce and a community leader who has been out there with the rallies in the last 24 hours. And we appreciate your voice. Thank you for making time to be on the program today, Adrian.
Thank you, Evan.
Daniel Ponder from the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Always good to have you, Danielle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan.
Reverend Lewis Stewart, I always wish the circumstances of these conversations were different, but I'm always appreciative of your perspective and the perspective of UCLM. Thank you, Reverend.
Thank you, sir.
And we've got members of the Police Accountability Board joining us at the top of the hour. Stay with us.